Now, on the BBC World Service, one of the world's greatest scientists is put under the microscope. Here's A.C. Grayling with Exchanges at the Frontier.
Hello from the Henry Wellcome Auditorium at Wellcome Collection in London. We're here to meet a great pioneer of neuroscience, someone once described as the Marco Polo of the brain, a scientist who has so revolutionised understanding in his field that it's been said he's done for the brain what Galileo did for the cosmos. I'm talking about V.S. Ramachandran. But before we bring him on, can anyone tell me why I'm carrying a medium-sized mirror? It's got nothing to do with vanity or the hairstyle. Anybody got any idea at all why I might be carrying this mirror? Yes?
His experiments with phantom realms.
That's exactly right. Because of his extraordinary low-tech work, helping to alleviate the suffering of people who have what's known as phantom limb pain. More on that soon. There's also another reason why I brought the mirror out. Yes?
Mirror neurons.
Mirror neurons, that's exactly right. Ramachandran boldly claims that a circuit of the brain which fires when we see other people doing things could be the foundation of all culture. And the lack of this function in the brain, he suggests, might be the cause of autism. Is he right? And what can the study of unusual syndromes tell us about how things work inside our skulls? Will you please give a warm welcome to one of the best-placed people to lead us through the pathways of the brain, the director of the Center of the Brain at the University of California, San Diego, Professor Vilyana S. Ramachandran. Rama, your work has involved detective investigations, discovering the causes and treatments for many obscure and extraordinary syndromes. Let's talk a bit about this very important work that you did with phantom limb pain. And perhaps you can start with a brief description of what a phantom limb is.
Yes, most people already know this, but briefly, if you lose an arm in a car accident, or there's a gangrene and the arm is amputated from surgery, you wake up from anesthesia and you continue to vividly feel the presence of that arm. It's called a phantom arm. In fact, when you remove the sheets, the patient's very much surprised, saying, "My God, there's no arm. You've removed it. You actually have removed it. I thought it was still there." So this extraordinary phenomenon is called a phantom limb. And it's been known for hundreds of years, but mostly it's been in the realm of speculation and folklore and that sort of thing.
People didn't know
what's going on in the brain.
But what a lot of people didn't realize is that many of these victims of limb loss suffer sometimes excruciating pain in the limb which isn't there.
That is correct, and that's why it becomes clinically very important. About two-thirds of the patients, first of all, 98% of patients after amputation experience a phantom limb, and about two-thirds of these patients experience intense pain in the missing arm or missing leg, called phantom pain.
Two-thirds.
Now, it is ironic because people originally said that one of the common theories, prevalent theories of phantom limbs was a Freudian one. The idea is that your arm is missing, but you have a wish fulfillment, you want the arm back, so you continue to hallucinate the presence of that arm, which is silly because they all feel pain. Well, why would you want the pain back? So that doesn't make sense.
I mean, it's an extraordinary number, that, isn't it? Two-thirds of people have that. Your first phantom limb patient was a man you call Victor. Now, he lost his left arm, was amputated below the elbow. But that missing arm gave him a great deal of pain. Can you explain to us what happened when you started to prod his face with a cotton bud?
Yes, well, we had Victor come in. He had lost his left arm crossing the Mexican border, had a car accident, lost his left arm, and had a vivid phantom left arm for the last 1 month since his accident. He came to see me at that time. He had excruciating pain in the phantom as well. But simply out of curiosity, out of just a routine medical testing, I touched various parts of his body and asked him where he felt the sensation and what he felt. So I would touch his face, his shoulder, his chest, his other arm, his leg, ask him, "What do you feel?" So I touched him on his forehead. He said, "I feel you're touching my forehead with a Q-tip. That's my right cheek. That's my right shoulder. That's my right belly. And it tickles when you press me there." Okay. Then I took the same Q-tip and touched the left side of his face. And I remember his left arm had been amputated below the elbow, and he had a phantom left arm, left hand. When I touched the left side of his cheek, he looked very surprised. And he said, "My God, doctor, I feel that in my phantom left thumb, my missing left thumb." And then I moved the Q-tip, touched his upper lip, and he said, "My God, that's my index finger I'm feeling. And then that's my thumb." And then I moved the Q-tip to another part of the face. "And that's my pinky." So different fingers were mapped onto different specific locations on the face. Now, why would this happen? This is what gives this whole enterprise this Sherlock Holmes-like quality. You know, a completely incomprehensible, bizarre. Why would somebody say when you're touching his face, he feels it in his phantom limb? The answer lies in the manner in which the surface of the body is mapped onto the surface of the brain. So, for example, if you look at the right side of the brain, remember Victor's left arm had been amputated. If Victor had been normal, if his arm had been intact, and you were to map every point on his body surface on the surface of his brain, there's a vertical strip of cortex called the somatosensory cortex, where there's a complete map of the surface of the body on the surface of the brain. So every point on the body surface is a corresponding point on the map. That's why you call it a map.
There's a picture, isn't there, of you can drape the body over the surface of the brain and you see the correlations between different areas. That part of the brain sometimes called postcentral gyrus, isn't it? And you say that the body region is represented onto that bit of the gyrus, but it's a puzzle as to why one area should come to be represented by another area. So what's happened here, there's some kind of transference from the missing left arm to the side of the face. Is that because of the proximity in that map on the brain?
Yes, well, that's a good question. So what happens is the hand representation in that map, the map is orderly and systematic, as indeed any map should be. Like you said, there's a pictured whimsical cartoon diagram, which you see often in textbooks, of a person draped around the surface of the brain. But one peculiarity of this map is the hand representation is right next to the face. We don't quite know why. It's a continuous map, except for the fact that the hand is next to the face. So what happens, we conjecture, is when you remove the hand region of the brain is hungry for new sensory input. So the sensory input from the face skin, which normally goes only to the face area of the brain, now invades the vacated territory corresponding to the missing hand, activates the hand region of the brain, fooling the person into thinking that you're touching his hand. Therefore, when you touch his face, he thinks you're touching his hand.
Well, it's a remarkable discovery about this way that the brain has this picture in itself of different parts of the body.
And the picture is modifiable.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. We've come on to that one. But here, my mirror can come into action here, because if we have a look at it, you might be able to tell us a little bit about how useful such a simple thing as a mirror like this can be in dealing with somebody who has phantom limb pain.
Well, this is a long story, but very briefly, if you hold the mirror, yeah. My right hand is the phantom, and I put it behind the mirror here, and then I put my left hand on the left side of the mirror. This is the shiny side of the mirror. And I look inside the shiny left side of the mirror. I see a reflection of my real hand superposed on the felt location of the phantom. So I look in here, and I do this. I'm feeling my phantom wiggling. I'm seeing my phantom wiggling its fingers, clenching and unclenching the fingers, moving, waving goodbye, conducting an orchestra, whatever. And then I'm looking in the mirror. It looks like my phantom's doing the same thing, but of course my phantom's not doing anything. It's just sitting here, right? Now, the astonishing thing is when I do this, many patients report that they feel the phantom mimicking the movement of the real hand. Simply because they're watching the phantom move, they get the visual illusion that the phantom is moving. That creates the tactile illusion, somatosensory illusion, that the phantom is also moving. And this sometimes is useful clinically because very often the phantom is an excruciatingly clenched position. The patient will say things like, it feels extremely tight and painful. And the patient will say, I'm trying to open the fist hoping to relieve the pain. And then the patient starts sweating and says, somehow I'm not able to open my clenched fist. So this is an oxymoron. How can a phantom be paralyzed? Right? So what we found was if you do this and you open the normal hand, which of course is easy to open, it looks like the phantom is opening. And the astonishing thing is it starts feeling like it's opening. And then you unclench your clenched phantom fist and the pain gets relieved in many cases. Not in all the patients, but in many patients.
Well, so you can see here when you look at the reflection of your hand in the mirror. In fact, it looks as if you're looking right through the mirror, as if it's a transparency, and you're seeing the other hand there. Well, one of the first patients you worked on is a man you called Jimmy, and you tried this technique with him. What happened with Jimmy?
I can't remember if his name was Jimmy, but let's assume it was.
Says so in your book.
Because sometimes I use pseudonyms. So what then happens is, well, in the case of many patients, when the real hand, intact hand, opens itself, opens the fingers, it looks like the phantom is opening and the pain gets relieved in many of them. But if you keep doing this repeatedly, some patients, including Jimmy, the phantom disappears completely, vanishes. And the patient is astonished by this as you. So I tell my medical colleagues, this is the first example in the history of medicine of a successful amputation of a phantom limb. using visual feedback. This is because you're producing tremendous sensory conflict. You know, vision is telling you the phantom is moving, but there is no information coming from the hand because it's been amputated. And one way the brain deals with conflict is to say, to hell with it, there is no arm. And the arm just disappears. As a result, you go into this form of denial or inhibition. And as a bonus, the pain disappears as well, because you can't have disembodied pain floating out there in space.
Well, it's very remarkable because it's so simple a technique, and it uses such low-tech equipment to achieve it. Is it exportable? Can you use the same mirror technique to help with other things? For example, paralysis resulting from stroke, maybe?
It can be, but before I get to stroke, it turns out there's another syndrome called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, or complex regional pain syndrome, type 1. Okay. All that means is we don't know what it is. This happens when you have a trivial injury to a metacarpal bone, say a finger bone. And ordinarily, after this trivial injury, you know, there's acute pain as a result of the fracture. And then after a few weeks or a few months, the injury heals, the pain goes away, the swelling and inflammation goes away, and that's a normal part of healing, right? But sometimes what happens is the finger gets permanently immobilized, permanently painful, inflamed, swollen, and the pain spreads from that little finger to your hand, to the arm, to the elbow, to the entire arm. So the entire arm is now swollen, red, warm, and intensely painful, and for life. This is called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. There's no known treatment for this. Sometimes things like sympathetic ganglion block or ketamine anesthesia help to some extent. But by and large, there's no simple procedure you can use to treat these patients. Well, guess what happens? You put a mirror there, put the painful arm, if you could hold this up again, put the painful arm on the other side of the mirror. Look at the painful arm is also paralyzed. Not really paralyzed, but the patient refuses to move it because any attempt to move the paralyzed arm creates excruciating pain, so effectively it becomes paralyzed. So he looks at the mirror reflection of the normal hand, so it's optically superposed on the paralyzed, quote-unquote paralyzed, painful arm, and then he moves his real hand. Then what you do is you ask him to move both hands simultaneously, generating synchronized movements, sending motor commands to the two hands that are in synchrony. Open, close the fist, wave goodbye, do whatever you want, but do it symmetrically. Now, immediately he said, well, doctor, I can't do that with my paralyzed, painful hand because it becomes very painful. Then he said, try anyway, you know, try at least a little bit. And he does that. Astonishingly, the painful arm, painful hand, appears to move, and it feels like it's moving, and the pain gets reduced. And after a few trials, the pain seems to diminish more and more often until it goes away permanently.
That's very remarkable.
Because the brain has learned you can move that hand with impunity without any pain. Yeah. Therefore, it's okay to open the hand. Yeah. And the pain goes away.
Now, the two different things happening there. One is mobility being restored. The other is that pain is being diminished by it. And obviously, there has to be a very, very deep connection there. Okay. But I suppose a lot of people would be really interested in the question, can you do this, for example, for stroke victims? I mean, that's a plague, especially developed societies. Can this treatment be used for them?
Yes. Before I answer that, one thing I want to mention is, you mentioned the pain goes away and the paralysis goes away. In addition to that, the swelling, inflammation, the redness, all of that goes away as well. Now, you cannot fake that. Pain, you could say somebody's making it up. He likes the mirror. He enjoys it. He wants to please the physician, so he's saying, oh, it went away. But people have done controlled experiments on this and shown in placebo controls that pain still goes away. But you can't reduce the inflammation and the redness and the swelling just by thinking about it. So this is clear proof that, in fact, that something's happening with the mirror that's actually coming, feeding back and affecting your skin. So talk about mind-body medicine. It's the best example I can think of the mind influencing the skin directly.
I mean, what we like in science is empirical, objective, observable results. And this is not just a question of subjective reports.
That's correct. You can start with a subjective report, but sooner or later you need the objective evidence. And both the pain of reflex sympathetic dystrophy, somebody recently took 50 patients and gave 25 of them just plexiglass, no mirror. 25 of them were given mirrors, and they were crossed over, and this placebo-controlled trials were done. And all 25 were on the mirror, recovered substantially from the pain. 25 on the plexiglass, nothing happened. And then they were crossed over, the people on plexiglass were put on the mirror, and their pain went down and stayed at the lower.
Now, have you had success with stroke victims?
Yes, coming to stroke now. So it works best, oddly enough, for reflex sympathetic dystrophy, for non-phantom pain. It works quite well for phantom pain, especially in some patients. It works for stroke patients, but only in some stroke patients, especially people who have recently had a stroke. Mm. Once you're past a few months, it doesn't work. So this is still being studied, still in the early stages, but sure, it turns out that if you use mirror feedback, some patients do show substantial recovery from stroke. There are a number of studies out there.
Now, what all this work seems to suggest is that the old-fashioned view about fixed modules in the brain, fixed capacities that the brain has, is not quite correct. It says something about how, you use the word, plastic that the brain is. I mean, that's a very important finding.
Yeah, absolutely. Beyond its clinical implications, immediate clinical implications, which are, of course, important, it has an overarching theoretical implication, which has to do with how dynamic the brain is. I mean, the old view comes mainly from MIT. The notion of the brain being independent modules, each module performing a highly specific function. It's sort of what I like to call the serial hierarchical bucket brigade model of brain function. So at an early stage, something is computed, and after the computation is completely done, messages then sent over to the next stage in processing, additional computation is done, something is made explicit, then goes to the next module, computation is done, so on and so forth. So there is the serial hierarchical modular architecture, and the modules don't interact much with each other. They're relatively insulated from each other, and they are hardwired. They're laid down by genes and are not modifiable through early experience. What we're saying is all three statements are incorrect. In fact, the modules, so-called modules, are not entirely hardwired. They're in fact in a state of constant dynamic equilibrium with the environment, connections being constantly reshaped by the environment in which they are immersed. Not only that, they're in equilibrium with other brain modules, constantly being changed by activity in other brain modules. Not only that, they're in equilibrium with the skin. Talk about modularity. Here's a brain module affecting your skin, changing the swelling and the sweating and the blood flow in the skin. And as we shall see later, also in equilibrium with other brains, modifying connections through mirror neurons. So this gives you a picture of the brain that's completely different from the standard textbook view that there are all these isolated modules doing different things.
And it's a fascinating picture that we're going to be exploring some of these things later. But just before we do, let's have some questions from the audience about phantom limbs and the things that Ram has been talking about so far. There's a question up there.
Hello, my name is Martin Garthwaite. I'm from Imperial College London. The mirror and the phantom limb, it seems to me it's some sort of feedback loop that's going on with the brain. Have you done any work on imagination, imagining this in the mind's eye, you know, without physically using a mirror or any other enabling technology?
Well, if you just ask somebody to imagine, say, okay, somebody has a clenched phantom fist, it's excruciatingly painful. And he says he's trying to open it, but it doesn't help. And it becomes more painful if he tries to open it. He starts sweating. If he said, try and imagine it's opening, it'll help. He gets annoyed, actually. He says, what do you mean imagine it? The pain is perfectly real, and I'm trying to move my hand. I've been doing it all morning, and it just doesn't work. And I try it every morning when I get up, try to open my fist. It doesn't work. So the short answer to your question is, you need the mirror, you need the visual feedback. But after they've used the mirror for a while, somehow it coaches the patient to start using imagery. And some patients say that they can dispense with the mirror to some extent and start using imagery. But in general, the short answer is you cannot cloy the hungry edge of appetite by bad imagination of a feast, as the Bard said. I mean, you can, to a limited extent, simulate the effects of the mirror by using imagery, but only to a very limited extent.
That's very good. There's a question here in the middle.
Sophie Scott from University College London. I was wondering if you would find the same phenomena with the phantom limb effects in the feet and the leg, or if there's something specific about hands, because we manipulate and move things with our hands so much more than we do with our feet. We walk around on feet. We don't necessarily do very precise, graspable things with them.
The short answer is yes, you do get phantom legs and phantom feet. In fact, you get phantoms almost from any part of the body. You can't have a phantom brain, obviously. Although you wonder about politicians. But you do get phantom legs, phantom arms, even phantom breasts after radical mastectomy. One-third of women have phantom breasts with phantom nipple tingling. You can get phantom genital, phantom penis, after amputation due to carcinoma. You can get phantom internal viscera, like a phantom appendix, with characteristic spasmodic pain of appendicitis continuing to occur even after you remove the appendix. Phantom uterine cramps after hysterectomy for cancer. So almost any part of the body.
Does the mirror help as much with the
Well, obviously with the phantom uterus, you can't use a mirror. But phantom legs, people have tried, and it does work.
There's a question over here.
Hi, Tom's Easton from the Wellcome Trust. I was wondering with the mapping of the phantom limbs, if the hand is mapping to the face, when you touch the face, does the patient still feel the face? And if not, why does the phantom fingers take over? Why are they more important than the still existing facial parts?
That's a good question. Does the patient feel the touch exclusively in the phantom or continue to feel it in the face as well? I forgot to mention that he, in fact, feels two sensations, one on the face and simultaneously feels a sensation on the face and in the hand. That's what you expect and that's what you see. He stops reporting the sensation on the face because he knows that's where he's supposed to feel it. So after a few trials, he just says, I'm feeling it on my thumb. But if you question him, he says, no, I feel it here as well, obviously. Many, many patients have told me that if they have phantom itch, which is often happens in the phantom hand, you can't scratch the itch, obviously, because the phantom is, it's a phantom. But if they scratch the face, the itch goes away in the phantom.
Let's take one more and then we'll move on.
It's kind of a whimsical question, but a few years ago I had a bad bout of gout. And if anyone's ever had it, it's incredibly painful in your big toe. And it's very, very hard to walk and it's just really, really painful. Have you had patients that have lost a leg that have had gout or had symptoms of gout? And if so, can you treat for the same?
No, we haven't tried that, but recently there was a report that osteoarthritis, which affects 1 out of 10, especially among the elderly, so it's very, very common. The fingers swollen, the joints are swollen, and you look in a mirror or with a lens to change the appearance, make it shrink. The swelling actually gets reduced after a few trials, and the pain seems to subside substantially. So we are, in fact, doing experiments to try and patent this device to help people with, to patent it to make money, obviously, for the lab, but also mainly to help patients who have arthritis. Now, whether it applies to other forms of pain, I don't know. But it's astonishing to me that optical devices, whether it's shrinking lenses or prisms or mirrors, people are using even virtual reality now, but it's the same principle. So all of these, what they have in common is using visual input to alter not just the subjectively felt pain, but objective changes in your body and skin.
Right, now, just before we move on to discuss synesthesia, which is something you've done a great deal of important work on, I want to conduct one of Rama's experiments with this audience, if I may.
Sure.
This is known as the Boobah Kiki experiment. And in order to do it, I have to draw two pictures. So firstly, this is not great art, but as soon as I have my images here on the paper, one of them is a sort of amoeba-like blob on the page, and the other one is a rather sharp, jaggedy sort of image. Now, we've got two names. We've got the name Boobah, and we've got the name Kiki. And I want to ask you this. Rama, the picture's okay?
Yes.
All right. I want to ask the audience, which name goes with which picture? Anybody got a suggestion? Let me ask this lady in the front row. Which name goes with which picture? Yes, you in the green top. Got your two names, Boobah and Kiki. Which one?
Okay, so I'd say the blob is Boobah and the spiky thing is Kiki.
Okay, now let me ask you, who agrees with that? Put your hands up if you agree with that. Absolutely everybody in the room agrees that the blob is Boobah and the sharp thing is Kiki. Rama, what does that tell us?
Well,
about human beings, not just this audience.
It looks like an amusing little demonstration, but if you think about it, it's quite extraordinary, because what you have here, what's going on is the brain is saying, the sudden inflection of the visual contour, that sudden inflection there, mimics the sudden inflection of the sound, ki, ki. And the hair cells are all being excited sequentially. So the same thing, so the brain is able to abstract that quality of kikiness and ignore the fact that this is coming in through vision and that's coming in through hearing. Similarly, this amoeba-like shape, this bulbous shape, the gentle undulation of the visual contour mimics the gentle undulation of the sound, boo-bah, or the undulation of the tongue on the palate. Now you say, well, so what? Well, this is extremely important because what the brain is receiving from the eye is just a set of photons hitting the retina in parallel. What's going into your ear is sequential activation of your hair cells in your ear, the receptors in your ear, with the sound boo-bah. Same with the kiki. You've got a bunch of photons hitting your eye in parallel, and then in the ear, you're getting the sequential activation of hair cells saying, ki, ki, right? So this pattern of activity of neurons in the hearing centers in the brain and the pattern of activity of visual cells have absolutely nothing in common. And here's a bunch of cells firing, a bunch of cells firing. But the brain is able to extract the abstract quality of suddenness or kickiness or an in mathematical language, high spatial frequencies in the Fourier domain. And then the brain says that's what these two things have in common. So the process we call abstraction, which we humans excel in, we're already seeing in this Buba Kiki example.
And what this shows is that synesthesia, because this is what's happening here really, isn't it, is very commonplace, widespread in human experience. But we find some people have even more extreme examples of synesthesia. So, for example, people who, when they think of numbers or see numbers, see them as coloured.
Yeah. Now, the word synesthesia, one has to be careful using it. Strictly speaking, this is not synesthesia because the correspondence between the sound Kiki and the jagged shape is not arbitrary. There's a reason for the correspondence. In synesthesia, what happens is, described by Francis Galton in the 19th century, there are people who are otherwise normal, as many as 10%, who, when they see a letter of the alphabet or a number printed on a sheet of paper, will see colored tinged red or tinged green or tinged blue. 5 is red, 6 is blue, 7 is green, 8 is chartreuse, 9 is indigo. It's different for different people. So why would 5 be red and 6 be green? Now, the link there is arbitrary. Whereas here, it's not arbitrary. So studying synesthesia is what made us study this phenomenon, because it's another example of intersensory connection. But the phenomenon you're dealing with in synesthesia is quirky and not universal. You see it only in some people. Whereas this is, as you just saw in the audience, is universal. Okay. But they both involve cross-modal interactions, which I think is very important aspect of brain function.
All right, so given that difference then, how can we be sure that the connection that somebody makes between a number and a colour, let's say, is not the result of something purely psychological rather than neurological, that is something learned, for example?
Yeah, well, first of all, it runs in families. Galton noted that. And that could be due to learning, of course. So one theory is that these people are just crazy. They're just nuts. What do you mean 5 is red and 6 is blue? It doesn't mean anything. And we can discount that because, well, I don't know why, but it doesn't take you very far, you know, saying this is crazy. The other is it's based on drug use. These people are potheads or on LSD. That's why they see colors. Now, there may be some truth to this because it's much more common in California than here in London. But again, it doesn't explain what's going on. The third theory is that there's a genetic basis to this phenomenon, and it runs in families. Why should that be? And we have suggested, in fact, that there is a region called V4, color area V4, discovered by Samir Zeki, right here in University College. And right next to that is the number area of the brain. So the number region, the visual appearance of numbers, graphemes, is encoded in the fusiform gyrus in a patch of cortical tissue. And right next to it is a color area. So there is some accidental cross-wiring between number and color in the brain. So every time the guy sees a number visually, goes and activates a number neuron in the fusiform gyrus, and then it cross-activates the color neuron. So why would there be these cross-connections in some people? Now, the clue comes from what I just said. It runs in families. Now, why would that be? Well, it turns out that all of us, when we were little fetuses or little infants, all these different parts of the brain were connected to each other. There's a tremendous redundancy of connections, excess connections. And these excess connections are then pruned away progressively in early childhood by pruning genes to create the modularity that characterizes the adult brain, including a separate number region, separate color region, and so on and so forth. If this gene mutates so that there's inadequate pruning, so then adjacent regions remain connected to each other. So therefore, the color region and number region are connected, which they're not normally connected in you and me. So every time he sees a number, activates number, it also cross-activates color, just like the face and the hand. There's not anything dangerous. And in fact, people who have synesthesia claim that it enriches their lives. They see the world as more colorful, and they wouldn't want to lose it for anything in the world.
So we've got an emerging picture here, which is that in the phantom limb case, we've got connections between, for example, the hand and the side of the face, which is part of the natural way that the brain evolves, the representation on the brain of the body. But in the case of true synesthesia, what you've got is these connections haven't been pruned away. They've right. been left by this process in as many as 10% of people. That's quite remarkable.
But the other peculiar thing about synesthesia, if I might go off on a tangent, is that it's about 7 or 8 times more common among artists, poets, and other creative people.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about that, right. Because Franz Liszt, the composer, used to see colors when he heard sounds. And Nabokov also had this rather extraordinary... You suggest that there is a definite connection between the aesthetic and the synesthetic, in the sense that perhaps creativity has something to do with these strange wirings.
That's quite right. And it's long been a puzzle why this would be. I mean, why would these people have this abnormal quirk? Why would synesthesia be 8 times more common among artistic people? And that, I think, gives you an answer to a question that's always puzzled me, puzzled most people. Why has this so-called synesthesia gene survived, and why is it so prevalent in the general population? Why would 1 in 20 people, 1 in 30 people, 1 in 10 people have the ability to see 5 as red or 6 as green? Completely useless, if you think about it. Well, I think it has a hidden agenda, just like the sickle cell anemia gene, which protects you from malaria or sleeping sickness. That gene has a hidden agenda. It may well be that the synesthesia gene, even though it's useless and manifests as seeing colored numbers in some people, the hidden agenda of that is it makes some people more creative. Now, why would that be? So if this, let's think of what creativity is. Right? Let's think of Shakespeare saying it is the East and Juliet is the sun. When you say Juliet is the sun, you don't say Juliet, well, that's, she's a glowing ball of fire. You say
she might have been.
She might have been. You say she's radiant like the sun, she's glowing like the sun, she's warm like the sun, she's nurturing like the sun, so on and so forth. Your brain instantly forms all these metaphorical links. And Shakespeare, of course, was a genius at doing this. And so a metaphor like that involves forming links between seemingly unrelated concepts, like a celestial object like the sun, center of the solar system, and a young girl, but seemingly completely unrelated. Each of those words, sun and Juliet, produce a penumbra of associations with adjacent ideas and concepts. And these penumbras overlap. The region of overlap is what you call the metaphor. In other words, they don't have anything else in common. The sun does not have skin, it doesn't have hair, it doesn't have teeth. But what they have in common is the fact they're both radiant and they're both warm and nurturing. Now, what I claim is in synesthesia, because of the excess connections, these penumbras are much bigger. There's excess connections to start with, giving this person greater opportunity to link seemingly unrelated ideas and concepts. Now, you have to make the extra assumption that ideas and concepts are also, quote-unquote, localized in different brain regions. These people can effortlessly do these combinations, which you and I find so difficult to do.
I mean, it's a very, very interesting claim you make there. And by the way, somebody might also say there is an increased correlation between creativity and certain psychological pathologies like depression or schizophrenia and so on. But to go from sensory experience, seeing blue when you look at a number, to connections between concepts, that is quite a leap and a very, very interesting and suggestive one, and perhaps one that we will explore now. Because are there any questions? Anybody want to follow up on some of these points with Rama on synesthesia and what it means? There's a question up there on the right.
Tony Woods, coming back to the Bubar-Kiki experiment, would you expect the same result if we were all, say, Cantonese speakers or Swahili speakers?
It's a good question. The choice of these was somewhat arbitrary. By the way, I should mention, these were discovered by a Gestalt psychologist, Köhler, in the early 20th century, not by me. I'm just exploiting it for studying synesthesia-like effects. Okay? Having said that, this is just one example. Another example would be, first of all, to answer your question, it doesn't matter what your language is. If you've shown it to people who speak Tamil, right, or speak Thai, and its percentages may vary slightly. Instead of 99%, maybe 98 or 97%. Majority of people say that's Kiki and that's Buba. But we also have other examples, like imagine seeing a blurred line, like a very blurred line, or a very jagged sawtooth-like line. And I say, which is rrr, which is shh? What's the answer?
Jagged is rrr.
There's no alphabet anywhere in the world that has a jagged shape like that and has a rrr sound. And then you show it to somebody, a Chinese speaker or a Thai speaker or a Tamil speaker, they all say the same thing.
Yeah. Question here.
Yeah, Philip Coughlin, retired engineer. I guess most people experience this, but there can be passages of music that will suddenly send a shiver down your spine, and it's a real feeling. It's not imagined. Is this possibly a synesthetic effect?
Well, again, the problem with synesthesia is it's a word that means combining senses, so you can use it for any number of different phenomena. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm talking about a specific kind of synesthesia which you see in people, which is hereditary and which involves colors and numbers and is quite common. What you're talking about is something that we all have those experiences from time to time, and it's a fascinating phenomenon. But why you would put these types of music, but not just music, sometimes certain sounds, like somebody moving nails on a chalkboard, produces a shiver running down your spine, a tingling sensation. Anybody here feels tingling sensation going down their body when somebody scratches something? Yeah. Now, and that's going into the ear, and then it's producing somatic sensations. I don't know, you could make some sort of just-so story that hair cells in the ear evolved from lateral lines in fish. The hair cells in the lateral line. So maybe evolutionarily, these got assimilated into the ear, but the same nerve connections are there. So when you hear some funny sound, you feel it tingling down the body. I mean, that's just like any other evolutionary psychology theory.
Right, well, we move on now. You will have noticed a trajectory here, which is that we've gone from work that Rama has done, which is empirically, objectively, well-rooted in observation. And a lot of that work has suggested to Rama a number of ideas. You've had some intuitions about how the brain works, how some of these phenomena arise because of brain structure and plasticity. Very often happens in science that these sorts of intuitions and suggestions are very fertile. They provide the way for lots of new research projects and new ways of seeing things. And one really, really interesting and significant thing that you've done is to suggest there is something we could learn from this work about autism and about the origins of culture and the connection between those two things. In order to explain that, though, we've got to start by providing a definition of something which lies at the very heart of your thinking about this, and this is the mirror neuron. Now, these mirror neurons were originally discovered by an Italian scientist called Giacomo Rizzolatti. Can you explain what they are?
Yes, well, first of all, the part one of your presentation, my presentation, dealt with phantom limbs, and then part two on synesthesia. That's on much more solid ground. But still a great deal of controversy surrounds the topic of mirror neuron. The empirical discovery is not in dispute. What Rizzolatti and company found was, it's been known for a long time that in the frontal lobes of monkeys, in the motor cortex, premotor cortex, there are cells, which are called motor command neurons. These neurons will fire when the monkey reaches out and grabs a peanut. There'll be one neuron fired, or a small set of neurons. Another neuron will fire when the monkey grabs a lever and pulls it. Another neuron for pushing an object, another neuron for putting something in its mouth. So these are obviously called motor command neurons. Now, what Giacomo Rizzolatti and Jacoboni and others found was that a subset of these neurons, a small percentage of these neurons, well, not that small, about 20% of these neurons, will fire not only when the monkey reaches out and grabs a peanut, but when the monkey watches another monkey reaching out and grabbing a peanut. So it's a monkey-see-monkey-do neuron, or a mirror neuron, as they call them. Now, this is quite extraordinary when the observation is made when I first heard about it, and a lot of people had the same reaction. What it implies is that the monkey's brain, these neurons, the system of neurons, is doing a virtual reality of what's going on in the other monkey's brain or mind. The brain is effectively saying, same neurons are firing as would fire if I reach for a peanut, so that's what that monkey is up to. So it's an intentionality neuron. It's judging the other monkey's intentions and then reading the other monkey's mind, to put it metaphorically.
So monkey A reaches for a peanut, and these motor command neurons are firing. Monkey B watches this, and a subset of his motor neuron command neurons fire also, even though he's not reaching for the peanut. Why doesn't that translate into reaching for a peanut?
That's a very good question. And in fact, you do see elements of this in all of us. When you watch an athlete about to throw a javelin or throw a ball, you unconsciously do that, and that's your mirror neurons kicking in. You don't literally jump off and do it, mimic what he's doing. That's what you think, partly because the frontal structures inhibit this movement. But it's easier to understand this in the context of sensory mirror neurons. Just as there are motor mirror neurons for movements, there are mirror neurons for sensations. And this occupies, these neurons occupy the same sensory cortex, which I told you about in the context of phantom limbs. Not the primary somatosensory cortex, but a region behind it called secondary somatosensory cortex, which receives tactile sensations. So you touch any part of the body, there's a map of the body surface in the brain, which the cells get activated. This has been known for decades, right? There's a sensory map. Some of these cells will fire in my brain if I watch you being touched in the corresponding location. So this allows me to empathize with you. The neuron is saying, what's happening to the other person is the same thing that would happen to you if you were touched. But you don't literally feel that person's qualia or subjective sensations. Why is that? The reason for that, there is another set of neurons which is not firing, which is signaling your own touch sensations, but not firing when I look at you. Those neurons are informing the brain, look, buddy, you're not being touched. So in other words, to put it crudely, the sensory signals coming from your hand, null signals, telling your brain, you're not being touched. So don't actually feel the touch sensation. Empathize by all means, but don't start feeling the sensations. That would be really strange. Okay? Now, how do you prove this theory? Well, there's an immediate prediction. If it's really true that my touch mirror neurons are firing when I merely look at you being touched, the reason I don't experience the touch is because feedback from my own hand skin is vetoing part of the output of the mirror neurons and saying, look, you're not being touched. Then if I remove this arm, then I should suddenly feel your touch sensations in my arm. I watch you being touched, stroked, or pinched. I should feel the touching, stroking and pinching in my phantom arm. And astonishingly, 100 to 200 years of phantom limbs had been known about. Nobody had tried this. So we brought the patient in, had him sit in a chair, and said, look, Derek, I just want you to watch me. And I'm going to stroke and touch and tap my hand, and I want you to feel your own phantom. Tell me if you feel anything at all, or feel nothing, right? So he started doing this. He says, oh, my God, that's amazing. I feel the same sensations in my phantom wrist and in my phantom thumb. There's always a little delay of a couple of seconds before he started feeling it, but it's unmistakable, and we've seen it in many patients. Not only that, this particular patient went home, and he called me up very excited the next day, and he said, you remember I had this excruciating pain in my phantom knuckle and in the ball of my thumb. And then, of course, I couldn't massage my own phantom because there's no arm there. So I asked my wife to massage her knuckle while I simply watched her massaging her knuckle. And this was felt in my phantom and instantly relieved my phantom pain. So the phantom massaged relieved the phantom pain. Now this, I should add, has not been tested clinically in controlled trials, but we're planning to do that.
But it has a dismaying suggestion that if you want to enjoy other people's pleasures, you have to chop off parts of yourself. But it's a very interesting connection. Now, you went from observation of those phenomena to a thought about autism. Explain that connection.
Well, in the motor realm, you said there are mirror neurons that fire when I watch you moving. So I'm able to gauge your intentions, put myself in your shoes, look at the world from your vantage point, right? And that's critical for theory of mind, knowing what you're up to, seeing you as another person, as an intentional being. Now, one of the main deficits in autism, if you make a list of deficits you see in autism, lack of theory of other minds, lack of empathy, lack of ability to read your mind, read your intentions, difficulty in imitation with other people, and inability to engage in pretend play. When you do pretend play and you pretend you're Superman or Mighty Max or whatever, then you temporarily put yourself in the shoes of that doll or action figure and you enact these games. Autistic children don't do that. So they lack empathy, lack of theory of the mind, lack of pretend play, and all of these are highly suggestive of the properties of mirror neurons. If you make a list of what's gone in autism, what's gone wrong in autism, and properties of mirror neurons, there's a very good match. So, and conversely, there is no other disorder which you see which produces precisely these symptoms. So we suggested about a decade ago that the main cause of autism may be a deficit in the mirror neuron system. Now I should add to this, saying we found some empirical, it was just a theory, we observed the correlation, suggested this, it's called the shattered mirror theory of autism, and we found some empirical evidence using brain imaging, confirmed by two or three other groups, including Muthukumar Swami and Jacoboni and others. But there's one or two groups recently, about 6 months ago, claiming that they do not see any deficits, mirror neuron deficits, in autistic brains. So this is still controversial. So I would say at this point the evidence is compelling or suggestive but not conclusive. Because soon after that paper was published, yet another paper came out a couple of months ago claiming there are deficits in the mirror neuron system. So this is still...
So it's really up in the air here, because all the empirical work just doesn't settle the issue about whether or not these mirror neurons are firing. But of course, one thing one has to accept is that a theory of mind, that is a capacity to understand other people's behavior, to interpret facial expressions and things they say, to anticipate how they might act in certain circumstances, of course, is immensely complex. And the mirror neuron story, if correct, would be part of that story.
Yes.
Do you think, though, if the mirror neuron component of that story is right, does it suggest any kind of clinical possibilities?
Only in the sense that if the mirror neuron system is not completely damaged and there's some residual activity, then maybe you could enhance the activity of mirror neurons by making them mime people more often. Although initially it's difficult training them to mime, looking in a mirror, for example, and introducing little time delays in the mirror, doing all sorts of things to enhance the activity of the mirror neuron system. Maybe use certain drugs which may target the mirror neurons. No such drug exists as far as we know. But in the future, it might be possible. There are certainly drugs like oxytocin, which increase empathy between people and affiliation between people. And who knows, these may be acting selectively on mirror neurons, or even E, for that matter, ecstasy. But we don't know where these drugs act, so one has to be careful.
Okay, so the insight there, the possibility that mirror neurons play this important part in the etiology of autism, suggests the opposite, that they might play a very, very important part in much wider set of things. indeed our culture. And you make a very dramatic suggestion about this, very interesting suggestion, that maybe here lie the roots of the development of human culture about 60,000 years ago, you suggested.
The general idea is that people think of imitation as something, you know, you're mocking somebody, it's derogatory. But in fact, if you think about imitation, it's vital for acquiring skills very quickly. And if mirror neurons are involved in imitation, now there's some debate about, I say autistic children are bad at imitation, but in fact some of them do spontaneous mimicry. This is why I said it's important to think of the mirror neuron system, which involves an inhibitory component too, which stops you from mimicking, blindly mimicking what somebody is doing. It's a complex system, not just one neuron called a mirror neuron. The sudden emergence of many, many skills, use of tools, sophisticated use of tools, building of shelter, even hunting skills, all of this may have been very rudimentary or may have been invented by one very clever hominid or hominin, right? Very early in evolution, maybe 100,000, 200,000 years ago. But before the advent of a very sophisticated mirror neuron system with all the appropriate connections, these one-of-a-kind discoveries would then disappear very quickly in the population. It would have to, any skill, any sophisticated skill, would have to be acquired by a painful process of Darwinian natural selection, or it'll just die out, right? Or it won't emerge at all. But if once mirror neurons are in place, the skill of hitting two stones together, lighting a fire, or take a favorite example as a polar bear. To evolve a fur coat, it'll take hundreds of thousands of years through natural selection. But if one very clever person slays a polar bear, skins it, and puts the skin on himself, and a child or another brother or a sister, a kin, watches this taking place and imitates the skill, acquires this in one generation, skipping 100,000 years of evolution. So suddenly what was Darwinian evolution becomes Lamarckian.
A last question for me, really. Your work has come out of clinical work. A lot of it has been based on very simple experiments, very low-tech equipment. A whole cascade of wonderful insights have come out of your work, and you've had a big influence in this field. How do you see the future of neuroscience now? It's a rapidly evolving field, obviously developing very fast, and with all the very high-tech equipment that we've got that helps us to see real-time activity in the brain. How do you see it developing? Where is the next big jump going to be?
Well, the high-tech stuff is extremely important, of course, but for me, it lacks the aesthetic appeal of doing very simple experiments. You see, if you have a lot of high-tech stuff going on, it gives you more opportunity to massage the data. You see, because the longer the distance between the conclusion and the experiment, the greater the opportunity to unconsciously massage the data and get the result you want. And a lot of this goes on in brain imaging. Secondly, it has this slightly boring, I don't want to criticize people who do imaging because I do some myself, boring aspect to it. You know, you go around conferences, you see these posters, and nothing, all you see is pictures of brains with little red spots on it. So, you know, spots keep changing their location every year. But you know, it has this banal quality to it. So a lot of doing simple experiments is really the aesthetics of it. But also I think sometimes you make interesting discoveries doing it.
Well, Rammer has certainly made a lot of interesting discoveries. This is your opportunity now to ask questions about anything that we've talked about, but in particular these more speculative areas suggested by some of this work. Who would like to? Lots of hands going up now. Can we start with this lady in the middle here?
Hello. I was just wondering if any work had been done on mirror neurons in very young babies or also in perhaps young monkeys, if not in babies, because it's not possible. And the reason is that when I watch my son, I often see that he can't control his impulse. When he sees another baby play with a toy, he has to go and grab that toy, and it has to be that one. And I wonder if that's because he doesn't have the inhibitory pathways to control his impulses.
It's a good observation, and indeed the frontal lobes develop later in life. So it's possible that this tendency to mime or spontaneously imitate is there in childhood. And of course, in childhood is when it's most important, because you're trying to assimilate parental skills. How early does it emerge? Well, we don't really know. And it raises the whole question of to what extent are mirror neurons hardwired, to what extent are they acquired? And I think to a large extent they are hardwired because their goal is to try and acquire new skills. But it's possible that they're fine-tuned by early experience.
Question right up at the top.
Daniel Glazer from Wellcome Trust and UCL. Do you think there's a possibility that neuroscience in our generation or future generations will come to infect how we regard ourselves? Do you think everyday life will come to seem different as the findings of neuroscience become absorbed into culture more generally?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. To some extent, the answer is obvious. I mean, just as knowing that we are not the center of the solar system, we're just spinning around the sun, has affected our conception of ourselves, that we're not special in the universe. and thinking about human nature and things like love, and if you take the romantic view that there is greater beauty and truth and meaning in a teardrop than in the entire cosmos that physics has described, or you could take the view that knowing that everything happening in love and charity and pity and all that is just activity of little wisps of jelly in your brain has a, I was going to say humbling effect, but also humiliating effect on you to some extent. So it's going to change the way you think about yourself and your relationship to the world and to the cosmos. But exactly how it changes you might depend on the individual's reaction. What would you think about that?
Well, I was very intrigued by something Rama said, that knowing that all this lies in the brain and brain function, so it can actually be very useful. So your beloved says, do you really love me? And you can say, yep, you can inspect my brain and you see all the right bits are working.
You can see I'm not faking it.
There was a question here.
Would the mirror neuron theory have, is there any thoughts in that in how that may connect to other sorts of conditions or syndromes such as psychopaths and psychopathy and lack of empathy?
Yeah, many groups, including our group and Tony DiMaggio, all of us have suspected this, that maybe a deficient mirror neuron system in childhood leads to autistic patterns of behavior, whereas another form of it may lead to a complete lack of empathy and tendency to regard people as automata, and not empathize with their suffering or their pain may lead to sociopathic behavior. But this has never been studied empirically. But it's a good suggestion. And conversely, people who have an excess activity... You know, one thing I'd be careful of is not to attribute everything to mirror neurons. It's not one tiny group of neurons that's doing everything. But it is intriguing that many of these syndromes you can begin to explain in terms of activity of neural pathways. So, for example, people like Gandhi or people like the Mother Teresa and all that, who knows, they may have a more sophisticated mirror neuron system. And that's why it makes them much more empathetic than all of us.
This lady here in the middle.
Going back to Sophie Scott from University College London, it is quite striking in your presentation you were referring to a role for mirror neurons in perspective taking and theory of mind and empathy. And psychopaths do have demonstrably poor empathic relationships with other people, but they have extremely good theory of mind because they're fantastic manipulators of people. So I was wondering where you see the difference lying between these, because it's not one and the same thing.
Well, it's a very good question. You'd have to argue that they have the intellectual... Theory of mind is not one thing, but a multi-layered thing. They have an intellectual theory of mind, whatever that means, but the emotional component, the empathy component, is impoverished. And there may be different neural systems which mediate this. For example, we know that anterior cingulate has mirror neurons for pain, empathy for pain. There are neurons which will fire when you poke the person with a needle, also fire when you watch somebody being poked, creating the spontaneous empathy for pain. I can imagine somebody not having that kind of empathy, but still having an intellectual appreciation of what his thought, internal inner thoughts are, and then manipulating those thoughts.
Well, this has been a really wonderful, fascinating discussion. Rama, thank you so much for that. We've, I think, learned a great deal. I'd like to invite you all, please, to give Rama a very, very warm round of applause. Thanks.
Exchanges at the Frontier is presented by A.C. Grayling. The series is produced by Charlie Taylor.